There are 12 regional Federal Reserve banks. We are going to talk to number 6 today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Thursday today, the 14th of November. Good as always to have you with us, everybody. Jay Powell wrapped up day 2 on Capitol Hill today on what can best be described as a mellow note for the Fed chair, all indications being that December's meeting will bring nothing on interest rates. But while Jay Powell gets a whole lot of press here and elsewhere, it's useful and informative to remember that chair though he may be, Jay Powell ain't all that. There are other members of the Fed's Board of Governors. There are the presidents of the regional Federal Reserve banks as well, of which Rafael Bostic is one. He is the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta.
How are you, sir? Kai Ryssdal, nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
He's been there almost a year and a half. President Bostic has the first African-American to run a regional Fed bank.
So this is our Hall of Presidents, an ode to the past of the bank,
which is
pretty...
I'm also obliged to note it's a whole bunch of old white guys.
Well, yeah, it's a little different today, which is a good thing. You know, the Fed is not known as like on the cutting edge of these sort of things, but we've actually made some good strides in the last couple of years, so I'm hopeful that we will continue to do that. We talk about this a lot.
The Atlanta Fed is the 6th Federal Reserve District headquarters, which, Bostic says, as we stand in front of a wall-sized map in the very nice boardroom, he says that's kind of a bellwether for the national economy.
So 6 states. Yeah. We have a little bit of everything. And if you think about sort of what goes on here, I got Appalachia. Yeah. I have the coast. I have energy. I got military. If you look at our economy, we're 1/6 of the U.S. economy. And our distribution of industries basically matches the United States. So we're a mini U.S. in the 6th District alone.
A quick walk to his office, and we got going for real.
Thanks for taking the time to do this.
Of course. You know, I'm a big Marketplace fan. I listen to you guys all the time.
That's very nice of you to say. How are we doing?
Pretty good.
Mostly?
Pretty good. You know, every now and then I get a little tense about things. But
Well, look, say more about that. What are you tense about right now?
So a couple things. So one is just how the economy, how Americans live their economies very differently. And the way we talk about it, I fear doesn't actually speak directly to a lot of folks. And so when I came here, you know, one of the things that was very interesting, I drove around, they flew me around. I had never lived in the Southeast.
Yeah.
So to represent the district, I really felt like I needed to go see things. I've become more acutely aware of like the split in how people are experiencing the economy, and that's leading to splits in how we talk about what America is. And so, you know, a lot of the fractured nature of our political discourse really does, in some ways, I think, revert back to these different realities of how people are living day to day.
Say more about that, because obviously on Marketplace, we spend a lot of time talking about the Fed, but we do it in terms of Jay Powell said this today, the Fed did that today, you know, take your pick. And I guess the question is, what should we be talking about in terms of the Federal Reserve and the central bank that maybe we're not?
So I'd say a couple of things. So one is that we actually are in a lot of communities. Just about every reserve bank has a lot of activities and initiatives that are designed to help communities be better and to address some of their challenges and weaknesses. You know, I was in Meridian, Mississippi, for example, had good conversations with their business leadership about what things, what their challenges are and then what kind of solutions are out there for them. Same thing in eastern Alabama. I was in Jacksonville and Anniston talking, and they wanted to talk about business strategies to try to attract new population. These are things we actually have a lot of expertise about, but I go around, a lot of folks say, I didn't know the Fed even cared about housing or any of these sorts of issues. And that's independent of the macro stuff, which you guys cover a lot.
Right. One of the things that's happening nationwide, and Chair Powell talks about this a lot, is that... one of the reasons the Federal Reserve is so intent on maintaining the conditions for the expansion to continue is that the lower part of the income spectrum is just now 10 years into this expansion, feeling it. How much does that weigh on you as not a member of the Fed writ large, but as the guy running the 6th District?
Well, I worry about this a lot. Now, let me say just one thing on this. This idea that the recovery has been uneven is more generic than just families across household levels. So there are a bunch of metro areas that are just getting back to where they were in terms of employment,
yeah,
in terms of house value. Historically, when we have these business cycles, lower income families, minorities, they're the last ones to get in. And so the longer these expansions are able to go, that provides more opportunity for the last ones. There'd be more of those last ones in. The thing that I worry about is I want to make sure those last jobs are sustainable. Yeah. We have a lot of history that shows that when the economy goes too aggressively beyond what you would call full employment, that there's often a recession that comes after that, and a lot of those jobs go away. And so the last in are often the first ones out.
Right.
So I want to make sure that as we do this, we don't go so hot and so fast that those jobs are not sustainable jobs, and that families wind up losing their station.
What keeps you up at night in this job?
So I worry a lot about psychology. The consumer is chugging along. There's all this noise that's going around. And there's always a question of, you know, to what extent is that noise going to affect or change people's sentiment? Are people going to get worn out and just say, like, I'm out? Or are they going to just keep their head down and keep going? And that's consumer side, but also businesses. You know, I know you talk to a lot of businesses. I do the same. And, you know, what they've told me so far is, you know, we're not going to jump out and do a lot of significant sort of these wild, bold actions until we know what the rules are.
Let me pick that apart a little bit. First of all, the consumer bit. Since you're a listener, which, by the way, thank you, you know that we spend a lot of time talking about consumers, and they're the ones driving so much of what's going on in this economy. How can that possibly be sustainable?
Well, it can be sustainable as long as economic growth is sustainable. You know, one of the things that's been interesting...
Well, wait, hold on. So economic growth now is slowing.
Slowing, but not slow.
Okay,
right? Fair. So I think it's important to make a distinction between slow and slower.
Okay.
When you think about what a long-run sustainable growth rate is, given labor productivity, it's about 1.8 or 1.9%. Mm-hmm. So this year, we will still be above our long-run sustainable level. So my models, we expected this to be a slower year than 2018, and we expect 2020 to be slightly slower than 2019. So slower does right. not necessarily portend a crisis.
Part two of what you were just talking about, businesses and them saying, well, we're going to wait and see how things go. There's a lot of uncertainty out there right now. If you're running a business, why would you do anything?
Anything different.
Anything different.
So I don't need to do anything different. Right? Look, 2018 for many businesses was a record-breaking year.
Yeah.
Right. So if they just stay at record-breaking levels, we should be good. So I don't need them to be bold. I need them to not freak out. I need them to have confidence that their existing business models are models that are sustainable over time. And my hope is that they continue to see signals that support that, so they keep going forward.
Dr. Bostic, thanks for your time, sir. I appreciate it.
Always a pleasure. Thank you for being here.
On Wall Street today, and I should say, by the way, that Dr. Bostic challenged us to find some numbers that would be relevant to Americans who aren't in the stock market. I told him we'd give it a try. More on that next week. But for today, on Wall Street, basically break even, we'll have the details when we do the numbers. Should you be in the market to buy a house, here with a sliver, a glimmer, perhaps, of good news. While, yes, home prices do keep going up month on month, nationally speaking, real estate bidding wars are at a 10-year low. Redfin, the big online brokerage, says just 10% of the offers its customers made last month got them into a back and forth over the price. And before you say, well, of course, Kai, because October's a slow month housing-wise,
You should hear me say that that number is down from almost 40% of bidding wars the same time last year. But from the rain on your parade desk, Marketplace's Amy Scott reports the reprieve may not last.
Debbie Quintana has seen the competition cool off in Fort Lauderdale. She's a broker with Q Real Estate Company. Last October, she listed a house on a Thursday and had five offers before the weekend, all at or above asking price. But this fall,
I've had listings stay on for 20 to 30 days before we even see an offer or two.
Quintana says people aren't as willing or able to keep paying higher and higher prices.
I think that people are being very cautious right now, especially with the political climate and tariffs affecting construction and their ability to remodel and renovate homes.
But if Quintana sees a slowing market, Lydia Lynn with One Realty says it's quite different in Denver. The market has been hot for so long, she says sellers are just asking for too much.
I feel like 80% of the sellers are listing high because they're like, oh, I'm in a great market and Zillow says my house is worth whatever and I want this kind of money. So, yeah, of course it's going to sit and of course you're going to see what it looks like softening, but it's definitely not softening.
In fact, Daryl Fairweather, chief economist at Redfin, says nationally demand appears to be picking up, driven by low interest rates.
But there's a bit of a delay between when buyers return to the market and when they actually start competing with one another and feel the pressure to compete.
She expects that pressure will grow if mortgage rates stay low, and so does the supply of homes for sale. And bidding wars will be back before long. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Natural disasters, hurricanes and floods, wildfires and tornadoes, are becoming more and more normal as the planet warms, which means the losses those things bring are becoming more normal as well. And that can put a financial strain on survivors for months and even years. That is certainly the case for the thousands of people who lost their homes and much more in the wildfires we've had out here in California the past couple of years. Pacific Gas and Electric, the big utility, has been found responsible for some of those fires, which, under the terms of its bankruptcy filing, mean it's also responsible for giving survivors financial assistance, if those survivors can get the paperwork done on time, as Marketplace's Samantha Fields explains.
Joseph Early lost everything when his hometown of Paradise, California, burned. His house, his parents' house, his law office.
The sense of loss of losing everything that you've acquired your entire life and your family has acquired. I mean, we had generations of stuff. So the depth of loss was extraordinarily deep.
To cope with all that loss, he buried himself in work, representing others against PG&E.
I just had no idea what it would be like to take on so many people's losses.
Especially knowing he's one of the luckier ones. Even now, a year later.
People don't have enough food, they don't have shelter, they don't have water.
Deborah Lucero is on the Board of Supervisors in Butte County, which includes Paradise.
You can imagine if they don't even have those needs met, it's highly unlikely they're trying to fill out some form online to maybe get some money.
But if people don't fill out the forms on time, they could also miss out on financial help that they desperately need. Tomorrow is the deadline to apply for the Wildfire Assistance Program, a $105 million fund set up by the bankruptcy court with money from PG&E, specifically to help people with immediate basic needs.
Food, water, first aid prescriptions.
Tiffany Norwood is a project manager with the fund, and she says renters are generally eligible for $2,500 and homeowners for $5,000.
It's not intended to cover all total losses.
Even insurance money, for those who have insurance, won't cover all losses for most people. That is why attorneys like Mike Danko are trying to get the word out about another critical deadline coming up, for people to file claims against PG&E.
Very simply, if you have a claim, your claim will be lost if you don't file a piece of paper.
Thousands of people who survived the Northern California fires missed the original filing deadline, so a judge this week agreed to extend it through December 31st. Ari Van Renen is a spokesperson for PG&E.
PG&E remains focused on ensuring fire victims and creditors are compensated fairly and expeditiously through the Chapter 11 process.
Joseph Early wants every single person affected by the wildfires, everyone who lost anything at all, to know that they can and should file a claim.
It's hard to get caught back up once you go deep, and just about everyone went deep financially just to survive, and then they never really recover.
This, he believes, is their best chance at getting close. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
Coming up,
you need stuff that can be used and passed on or sold onward over and over and over.
Spend more on your clothes. It trickles down. But first, let's do the numbers. Whole lot of flat today. Dow Industrials closed at 27,781, basically unchanged. NASDAQ 84.79, also basically unchanged. S&P 500, flat, 3,096. Walmart, down 0.2% today, despite posting better than expected third quarter earnings and reporting healthy growth in food sales and e-commerce. In other retail, Target up 2.3%, Macy's up 1% today, Cisco Systems down 7.3%, Kraft Heinz down 5.8% today after Goldman Sachs downgraded that food company. Bond prices rose, yield on the 10-year Treasury note fell to 1.82%, and you're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. One of the great big grains of salt that observers and analysts of the global economy have had to use in the past, like 20 years or more, has been when they're looking at Chinese economic statistics. Unreliable is a word that comes to mind. But today, the central government in Beijing said it's going to change for the better how local governments do their economic math. Marketplace's Scott Tong, our Shanghai bureau chief back in the day, has that story.
There's been skepticism about Chinese numbers at least since the Asian financial crisis of the 90s, when China went statistically unscathed. So says Tom Orlick at Bloomberg Economics. His book is Understanding China's Economic Indicators. In 2007, Orlick says the Chinese politician who had become Xi Jinping's number two man in Beijing kind of fessed up.
Li Keqiang had a meeting with the U.S. ambassador. And according to WikiLeaks, he said that China's GDP data was man-made.
As in overstated, especially at local levels, where politicians have had reason to cook their books, says Sarah Xu at the China Rising Capital Forecast.
They have in the past been promoted on the amount of GDP that they could generate. So they have an incentive to inflate the numbers.
Lately, the Chinese central government has tried to take over number counting. If it can go after dirty numbers, the thinking goes, it can cut corruption. But there's another numbers issue, says economist Eric Scissors at the American Enterprise Institute. China's GDP and housing prices and unemployment go up and down too smoothly compared to other middle-income countries.
They can go for periods of very strong growth, but if capital decides this is a bad risk and it leaves, you get a crash. This is very normal for everybody except China.
Scissors thinks today, China's growth rate is 2 points lower than the official 6%. Optimists say GDP numbers from Beijing match up well with indicators like electricity use and bank loans. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
What happens to the stuff we don't want anymore? Clothes and electronics, furniture, just stuff. Assuming you sell or give away or donate it instead of just throwing it away, then all that stuff becomes part of a whole different economy, a stream of secondhand goods that is as global as anything you buy new. That economy that stuff winds up in is the subject of a new book by Adam Minter. It's called Secondhand: Travels in the New Global Garage Sale. Adam, it's good to have you on.
Thank you very much.
I want to steal a line from one of the blurbs on the cover of this book, but I have to preface it by saying, wow, the scale of secondhand in this global economy is amazing. But somehow the verdict you come up with is hopeful.
It is, and it kind of has to be because we're generating so much stuff, and it's not just us in developed countries like the United States, but increasingly it's folks in developing regions as well, like China, who are generating it. But there are solutions out there, and I think we'll be able to manage it.
Give me a sense of scale, would you? And I don't know what metric you want to use, billions of tons, cubic feet, take your pick.
Well, how about just a region? If you go to West Africa, places like Nigeria, Ghana, and Benin, you would walk into any city or town, Lagos, Accra, Tamale, which is the capital of northern Ghana, and you'll find that probably upwards of 90% of the retail there is secondhand. And it's, 100% imported secondhand. That's not recorded by, most economic figures because we don't record secondhand retail so much as part of retail. But that's the reality. You just have to walk down the street and you'll see that this teeming, economically vibrant region is secondhand.
All stuff that used to be in somebody's closet, basically.
Exactly. Or garage. Yeah. We know that garages in Southern California are filled with secondhand stuff.
I want you to take me to Tucson, Arizona, mm-hmm. Because you spend a lot of time there. And I want you to talk to me about the role that a company that a lot of us kind of know of but don't really appreciate plays in the secondhand economy, Goodwill.
Sure. Well, Goodwill is the largest secondhand trader and sort of taker of goods. It's all donated in North America. They handle roughly 3% of the stuff in North America. And they are made up of a number of federations, member federations, and one of them is the Goodwill of Southern Arizona, which is where I spent time, which is a series of 16 stores and a few warehouses where they sell the stuff. So without this Goodwill, somebody in Tucson would have to invent it to get rid of all the stuff that people in Tucson are generating out of their homes.
The amazing thing about that chapter on Goodwill was, for me anyway, how, and I don't mean this pejoratively at all, how corporate it is, right? I mean, they're doing inventory control and they're moving things off shelves in regular rotations and they have, computerized inventory and they go, the manager of the store took you to the back and tracked her sales and in part was garments and part was, furniture mm-hmm. and this. I mean, it was incredible.
Well, they have to be because, the average thrift store in the United States is only able to sell about 1/3 of the stuff that gets donated. So the rest of that stuff, the other 2/3, becomes a cost. So it becomes incredibly important to be able to manage your inventory and know what's going on. And it's hard. If you're at Goodwill, you're getting your inventory every day. You don't know what it is. It's your obligation to sort it into what can be sellable and then price it and hope that you're pricing it at a way that it moves. And at the same time, you don't want to compete against your customers because Goodwill does. People use Goodwill as a source of inventory for their own eBay businesses and Poshmark businesses and all these online retail outlets that are now available.
For all the hope, to get back to where I started, that you see in the secondhand economy, really the thing is we just got to start using and buying and wearing less stuff.
Yeah, using and buying less stuff and using and buying better stuff. You need stuff that can be used and passed on or sold onward over and over and over. And increasingly, that's not the case. Something bought from a fast fashion outlet isn't going to make it through too many washes, much less to a secondhand dealer in Accra, Ghana. And so what I, really encourage people to do if they care about secondhand economies is to buy better stuff in sort of the virgin economy, the new stuff economy. And if that can happen, this stuff will circulate longer, and that's good for consumers and the environment.
It's a book called Secondhand, Travels in the New Global Garage Sale by Adam Minter. Adam, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thank you so much.
One perhaps surprising secondhand item that Adam covered in his book we didn't get to on the air, car seats. More from him about that at marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, a follow-up of sorts to Samantha Fields' piece about the wildfires and the economic aftermath. The chief economist at Bank of the West out here says he figures the fires and the forced blackouts we've been having as utilities try not to start any more fires will cost this economy $11.5 billion and would put the growth rate of the fifth biggest economy in the world, that'd be California if we measured things that way, it'd put California's growth below that of the national economy for the first time since 2010. All right, we got to go. Pretty much flat across the board on Wall Street today. Amir Babawi, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, and Heron Bekela are the Marketplace editing staff. Betsy Streisand is the managing editor. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.